rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded? Here's Tom Hartman.
Patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from California to Pennsylvania, beaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite radio system, streaming around the planet at airamericaradio.com, whiterosesociety.com, radiopower.org, whiterosesociety.org, excuse me, and CRN Digital on cable systems in 29 states. Welcome back to our program. Kevin Phillips is with us. Kevin Phillips, I have to say, Kevin Phillips, welcome to the program.
Happy to be here.
I just have to say, you are one of the most brilliant commentators of the American scene, bar none. I mean, I first became involved in politics in 1964 at the age of 13, going door-to-door for Barry Goldwater. And when your book came out in 69, by that time, my politics had flipped 180 degrees. And I was rather distressed by the emerging Republican majority. You now seem to have made a transition, as it were. Your new book, American Theocracy, The Parallel and Politics of Radical Religion, Oil, and Borrowed Money in the 21st Century. If it's okay with you, I'd like to try to, in the short time we have, touch on each one of these three.
Sure.
And I want to just say to my listeners, and we don't do a lot of author interviews on this program, and although I do, you know, a monthly one for BuzzFlash, but this is a book that every person listening to this program, Republican, Democratic, non-political, whatever, should be reading. You have written one of the most important books of this, certainly of this decade. You note in your book the reason for highlighting history's relative handful of covenanting cultures is the biblical attitudes their people invariably share, religious intensity, insecure history, and willingness to sign up with the Old Testament God of war for protection. And then you note, Israelis, and to an extent scripture-reading Americans, are on their way to being the last peoples of the covenant. Two questions. Number one, can you elaborate on that? What does that mean? What does that mean for America and for the future of the world? And wouldn't you throw Islam into that category?
Well, the covenant is essentially something that's, I think, a Christian conception. Whether you could put Islam in and borrow that same concept, or whether it's something related, I wouldn't try to say theologically. But what's happened over the years, Jews and then Protestants, Catholics basically didn't do this too much, have picked up on this. And you've had covenanting peoples in Holland, in Scotland, in the United States, the Puritans when they came. In some ways, the Mormons think of themselves this way. Elsewhere, you've had them in Northern Ireland, ferocious covenanting there. But it hasn't lasted in the last 20 or 30 years as things have changed in Northern Ireland. And you had them in South Africa, the Afrikaners, the Boers. And that, too, is pretty much dissolved. So that's why I say that the people of the covenant, the Christians of the covenant, are principally in the United States. And then you have the Jews of the covenant in Israel.
But it's more than just of the covenant. It's of a particular worldview, isn't it?
Yes. I mean, if you're a...
Which becomes a political worldview.
Right. It's an embattled people who believe that their tribulations qualify them as having been singled out and having a covenant with God. And generally, the whole history that breeds this attitude, it usually takes a couple of centuries to really set in. The people who have this attitude are very biblical, a sense of very embattled. They generally claim territory, or they relate to territory. It's just hard to describe it in a way that doesn't sound archaic, and in a sense it is archaic because of its biblical origins.
Kevin Phillips, author of American Theocracy. In the next hour of this program, I'll be discussing, debating, whatever, Rick Scarborough, who's published a book called Liberalism Kills Children. His proposal, his thesis, and that of many of these folks, is that Christianity is under assault. As a Christian myself, I find that rather ironic. Christians are certainly the majority in the United States. I'm wondering if your sense of it, certainly it seems to be, actually you build a very strong case for it in this book, perhaps you can expand for our listeners, that without that ultra-hyped, continuously hyped sense of persecution, a lot of these guys wouldn't have the power that they have, they wouldn't have the platform that they have, and they wouldn't have the followers they have.
Well, I think that's exactly right. And in the case of the South, the reasons why the Southerners are, in a sense, covenanters within the United States is the role of the Civil War in the interpretation that the South survived the Civil War. It stuck to its churches. Its churches regarded themselves as in battle. The Southern Baptists would not rejoin with the Northern Baptists. And they expanded. They expanded to fill in the old Confederacy. They expanded in the border states. They expanded westward. And now there are almost 20 million members of the Southern Baptist Convention, and that's as many as you get in all the mainline Protestant denominations combined. And it's a pretty militant culture in terms of its beliefs and its biblical fidelity, and they claim that George Bush is just as biblically faithful as they are.
And in large part, what sustains their tenacity and ferocity is their sense of being under siege.
Yes, their sense of being a regional people, a separate identity that they have and that they wouldn't give up after the Civil War, and that this has made them strong, but it always makes them, in a way, persecuted. And, of course, the Covenanters of all varieties have always felt this persecution, and that's part of what makes them tick.
They have to maintain it. Thus, the war on Christmas and the war on Christianity and all the stuff that they're hyping over at Fox News and whatnot.
Yes, but in fairness to them, I think if you go back in the 60s and 70s, there was an attempt on the part of liberals and seculars to push churches and religion further out of the public square. Mm-hmm. And we live in Connecticut near a little town, fittingly called Bethlehem, where they have a Christmas celebration, Christmas manger scene. It was really under attack. Now, it's gone so far the other way that you have a traffic jam at Christmas time.
Mm-hmm. Now, to move to debt, you and the economy in general, you talk about the German, the Japanese, the Swiss exports, the role of America relative to the rest of the world. You note, for example, the Germans, the Japanese, and the Swiss, in terms of production and exports and the on a per capita basis. You say the Germans, the Japanese, and the Swiss do this with workforce wages and benefits and industrial production costs as high or higher than those in the United States. Yet they are net creditor nations. We have become the world's largest debtor. They enjoy strong current account surpluses. We have the largest current account deficit in the world, I believe. And they have citizens who have achieved relatively high savings rates. What do they know that we don't know? What are they doing that we're not doing?
Well, one of the things they do is that they maintain a sort of national sense as well as an international sense. They're people that believe in their countries as something special economically and culturally. And they also have very, very successful export machines and focuses. They produce top-quality products, and they export them. And they do this because they pay a lot of attention to quality in a way that, in many ways, the United States has sort of forgotten about. If we buy something for $39, you know it's never worth repairing it. You throw it out when it starts to malfunction. The other thing they haven't done is they haven't become financialized countries. In the United States, moving money around now constitutes a larger share of the GDP than manufacturing does. It's really a striking upheaval. Financial services are 21% of GDP, and manufacturing's down to 14%. It was reversed in the 70s and 80s.
Yeah, that's the major shift that you document in your book, and I thought it was, you know, very, very well done. The hawking of America, massive U.S. international debt, is the product of domestic overconsumption. We have less than a minute left, Kevin Phillips. Are we facing a Great Depression? Have these guys sold us out?
I think we're facing a major and painful readjustment involving everything from oil to the excesses of debt and the probability that the dollar is overvalued at the present time. I think we face a wrenching readjustment probably in the next decade.
What can and should Americans do about that?
Start discussing it. Start forcing the politicians to pay attention. They don't want to confront all this. It's difficult. It would offend their contributors, so they'd rather just be like ostriches.
we've been living off essentially a credit card for decades now.
Certainly for the last 15 years, and it's got out of control after 9/11.
For the average person, what will be the consequence of this?
For the average person who doesn't have a lot of capital skills and education, they're going to be hard-pressed to maintain what they've got now.
Kevin Phillips, the book American Theocracy, The Peril and Politics of Radical Religion, Oil, and Borrowed Money in the 21st Century. Buy this book and read it. Kevin Phillips, thanks so much for being
with us. Nice to talk to you.
Good speaking with you. 16 minutes past the hour is the Tom Hartmann radio program.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartmann.
What a friend we have in W. Upright, strong, and resolute.
Our American Theocracy
God
music here.
God wished him to be our leader. The court could not but follow suit.
Indeed. Welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartmann here with you. 21 minutes past the hour. Broadcasting. Thank you for the quake in San Francisco, to the quake in San Francisco for loaning us a studio. Broadcasting live from San Francisco today. We'll be back in Portland, Oregon tomorrow. And everything you know is wrong. Could it be? Is the Bush administration planning a coup in 2008? Now, what I find so amazing about this, this is an email that I must have gotten, I don't know, 40 copies of this thing. It's flying all over the Internet. And it's from a publication out of the UK called The Register, theregister.co.uk, which is a legitimate publication. It's mostly an online techie publication. Talks about computer things. And they published this article. And it was, and you know, it says published Saturday, 1st April 2006. Now, that should have been the dead giveaway, right? This was an April Fool's thing. But what's so amazing about this is how many people took it seriously, because it is not inconsistent, tragically, with everything that we're learning about the Bush administration, about the fact that George W. Bush went to war in Iraq in part for oil, but in large part because he thought he could get political capital. It was part of the keep the minority Republicans in power of the majority of Americans. Yes, we have a war. Yes, a war president. You know, back in 99, Bush telling his biographer, Mickey Herskowitz, that if he gets elected in 2000, he's going to have a war with Iraq, and he's not going to screw it up the way his dad did. It's not going to be a short war. It's going to be a long war, so he can gain political capital, and he can get his mission accomplished. His mission, of course, to privatize Social Security. You'll recall in Texas, not only was he in favor of privatizing Social Security, that's what he ran for the U.S. House of Representatives on back in the 1970s when he lost. I mean, this is a guy who literally has failed at everything he's done. His oil companies went down in flames. He got bailed out. The only thing arguably that was successful was the Texas Rangers. And even there, his daddy's friends brought him in. His daddy's friends bought him out. He ran for Congress and he failed, and now he's doing the same thing with the United States of America, tragically. And part of his program when he was governor of Texas, and this is why, by the way, so much of it has failed, is because George W. Bush doesn't understand entrepreneurialism, doesn't understand business. He thinks being a CEO president means sitting around and giving orders and occasionally, you know, sort of paying attention, but, you know. But when he was governor of Texas, he even wanted to privatize the University of Texas system. This is a guy who absolutely believes that privatization of pretty much everything is the best way to go. And doesn't understand that there is a reason for governance. There is a reason for respecting the whole idea of we the people coming together and forming a government that can protect us from the predators among us, that can accomplish some of the things that we want to accomplish that we simply can't do on our own. I can't carry around a kit to test whether or not my food is safe. I can't evaluate the chemicals in my water before I drink it, coming out of the tap. I can't redesign my car to make it safe or make it more fuel efficient. I mean, there's a lot of things that simply, you know, when it was just life on the farm with, you know, mom and dad and the mule and the corn crop, it was just a whole different world. And Bush never got that. In fact, it's the opposite. They've been listening to these Ayn Rand folks and the objectivists and the libertarians and this whole idea that not only is government bad, but that somehow government is so bad that it is a force to be absolutely feared and destroyed. Now, interestingly, the Bushies don't believe this when it comes to police powers, because they're trying to expand police powers. But they use this rhetoric to try to destroy social programs in the United States and take apart Social Security and put the poison pill in Medicare of the drug benefit and pass out over $1 million to the churches in the United States last year, corrupting them politically and bringing many of them into the Republican fold. This is something that's just wrong. So anyhow, this April Fool's joke comes out from the Register. The U.S. Department of Justice and the Office of the White House Counsel are preparing a draft document laying out the president's wartime authority to remain in office past 2008, the Register has learned. The scheme is described as an emergency continuity presidency made necessary by the extraordinary circumstances and unique challenges of protecting the United States from the threat of international terrorism. And then they go through this so-called draft that they got from the Attorney General, where they're talking about, the appearance of a time limit. The Attorney General believes this to be satisfied by tying the duration of the continuing presidency to the duration of the global war on terrorism, that we can't call it a third term so we don't go up against the 25th Amendment and all this kind of stuff. And, you know, it's phony, but it wouldn't surprise me, and I think it wouldn't surprise a lot of Americans, if there is a conversation like this going on in the White House. The spooky thing. Our phone number, 866-440-8466, 27 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Don't you understand what I'm trying to say? Can't you understand the pain I'm feeling today? But I suppose there's no one in the way. No one's safe with the world in it.
Speaking of protest songs from the Vietnam era, welcome back, by the way. Tom Hartman here with you, 34 minutes past the hour. Anthony C. Zinni. Opposition to U.S. policy in Iraq began on the monsoon-ridden afternoon of November 3rd, 1970. Anthony Zinni was lying on a Vietnamese mountainside west of Da Nang, 3 rounds from an AK-47 assault rifle in his side and back. He could feel his lifeblood seeping into the ground as he slipped in and out of consciousness. He had plenty of time to think in the following months while recuperating in a military hospital in Hawaii. Among other things, he promised himself, if I'm ever in a position to say what I think is right about issues of war and peace, I will. I don't care what happens to my career. That time has arrived. Anthony Zinni was on Meet the Press this weekend. Alex, if you just fire off this, it runs a little long, but I just want you to hear this entire clip. This is General Anthony Zinni, a guy who has been there, done that. He was in Vietnam. He got shot up. He nearly bled to death. He has led troops into combat. He really understands it, just like Dwight Eisenhower really understands. Well, I'll come back with a rant after. Here's Anthony Zinni.
I saw what this town is known for, spin. Cherry-picking facts, using metaphors to evoke certain emotional responses or shading the context. We know the mushroom clouds and the other things that were all described that the media has covered well. I saw on the ground sort of walking away from 10 years' worth of planning. You know, ever since the end of the first Gulf War, there's been planning by serious officers and planners and others and policies put in place. 10 years worth of planning, you know, it was thrown away. Troop levels dismissed out of hand. General Shinseki basically insulted for speaking the truth and giving an honest opinion. The lack of cohesive approach to how we deal with the aftermath of political, economic, social reconstruction of a nation, which is no small task. A belief in these exiles that anyone in the region, anyone that had any knowledge would tell you were not credible on the ground. And on and on and on. Decisions to disband the army that were not in the initial plans. I mean, there's a series of disastrous mistakes. We just heard the Secretary of State say these were tactical mistakes. These were not tactical mistakes. These were strategic mistakes, mistakes of policy made back here. Don't blame the troops. They're the ones that perform the tactics on the ground. They've been magnificent. If anything saves this, it will be them.
Should someone resign?
Absolutely.
Who?
Secretary of Defense, to begin with.
Anyone else?
Well, I think that we those that have been responsible for the planning, for overriding all the efforts that were made in planning before that those that stood by and allowed this to happen, that didn't speak out, and there are appropriate ways within the system you can speak out, at congressional hearings and otherwise, I think they have to be held accountable. The point is, those that are in power now that have been part of this are finding that their time is spent defending the past. And if they have to defend the past, they're unable to make the kinds of changes, adjustments, admit the mistakes, and move on. And that's where we are now, trying to rewrite history, defend the past. Ridiculous statements that, well, wait 20 years and history will tell you how this turns out. Well, I don't think anybody wants 20 years to continue like it is now.
You know, one of the main points that Anthony Zinni made in that was pointing out that Donald Rumsfeld had just said that the mistakes that were being made were tactical, not strategic. This is military speak for saying it was the guys on the ground, it was the soldiers on the ground who screwed up Iraq. Not Rumsfeld, not Bush, not Cheney, the official, oh, not our fault, crowd. Really what you're seeing here, writ large, goes back to our original interview this morning with Kevin Phillips, where he was talking about, and in his book, American Theocracy, where he talks about our addiction to oil, the transfer of the United States from a manufacturing economy to an economy based on finance, which is a house of cards. We've been there before. We were there in the late 1920s. And the rise of the religious right. And setting that latter part aside for the moment, the conservatives had been chewing on this thing ever since 1948-49. They hated Roosevelt. They hated Harry Truman. And Harry Truman said, you know, when we put together Germany and Japan, let's put them together in a way that they have the protections that we have been talking about in the United States for the past 15 years, since the mid-1930s, the past 20 years for all practical purposes, since the Great Depression began in 1929. He said, let's take these things that we're starting to see work in the United States and allow the Japanese and the Germans to run with them. And they wrote into the Japanese, German, and German constitutions and laws that labor was protected. And this spread across Europe. You see, it's being undone now in France, thus the riots. And they wrote into the Constitution that there was a certain limits on the exploitation of labor. They wrote into the Constitution a progressive tax system. They wrote into the Constitution free unlimited health care for all persons. Health care is a right. And the conservatives have been going nuts ever since. They've been saying, no, we want to have a country where we can do like Truman did with Germany and Japan, and we can make it a conservative paradise, and we can show that the conservative vision is just as good for a nation as the progressive or liberal vision was back in the 1940s in Germany and Japan, which became the second and third largest industrial powers in the world, by the way. And so they got their chance with Iraq. They were chomping at the bit. They got their chance with Iraq. And they were going to do it differently because they were so convinced. The reason why Rumsfeld, over and over and over again, Rumsfeld ran into this thing with too few troops and force reduction scheduled to go down, and why the only thing that they were looking at was oil was because they were convinced, they actually believed their own PR. These guys, I mean, I suppose you have to give them credit, they actually believed their own PR, that if they allowed a country to be taken over by the multinational corporations and laissez-faire capitalism, unrestrained capitalism, the French would call it savage capitalism, was allowed to rule the country, that the result would be the rise of an extraordinary world power, that Iraq would become the not just the centerpiece of the Middle East, but the centerpiece of the world. Everybody would look at it and say, oh, well, the Japanese and Germans were, it was a good experiment, but boy, look at Iraq. I mean, this is what they were talking about in 2000, in 1998, in 1999, 2000, 2001, 2002. This is exactly what they're talking about. This is why they made a flat tax, a 15% flat tax in Iraq. This is why they're doing away with the food subsidies, the equivalent of a welfare program, food stamp kind of program. This is why they allow foreign multinational corporations to own anything in Iraq. There's no domestic percentage of manufacturing laws like there are in, for example, China, Mexico, countries that are still trying to protect their economies. We gave that up a while ago. And look at the result. Look at the result. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. And Janice in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, WPTT. Hey, Janice, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. I couldn't wait to come home and call you.
Okay.
I just ran into Mike Doyle.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, the first thing I asked him, because I've already called his office, to ask him to support Bernie Sanders' measure, to investigate the pre-war intelligence. And then I asked him
now,
about...
Mike Doyle is he's a congressman from Pennsylvania.
Yes.
Is he a Democrat or a Republican?
He's a Democrat.
Okay.
He's in a very safe seat, so I'm voting for Mike Isaac in the primary, and probably Titus North, the Green Party candidate, in the general. But anyway, I asked him about the Dominionists. When you had reported on the Dominionists paying rent for certain people.
Well, actually, I said that I didn't say they were paying rent. These guys are actually paying $600 a month in rent to them.
Exactly.
They're providing the house in which these people live.
Yes, that's what he had said. Okay, so he verified that he lives in a house with five Republicans and three Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
And he said it's basically just a flop house. They just come and they sleep there, and he's not part of this cult that people say that it is, but there are people in the house that are part of this, and he doesn't even know who the Dominionists are.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, he called it international, found some sort of international foundation, and then some other word, but that's the word that he used, that it is. So just thought that I would pass that on to you.
Well, thanks for the heads up. It's interesting that he either is unaware of, I mean, this is an organization that spent, has spent, it's a multi-million dollar organization. It's amazing that he's unaware of their activities or that he's unwilling to share with a constituent his knowledge of them, one or the other.
Well, exactly. But I think it's interesting because when people walk up to him on the street and say, hey, what's up with this? He was really, you should have seen his face.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So I think we have to just keep doing that.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. Good on you, Janice. I think it's great. Holding our elected officials accountable. Thank you very much. Wendy in Whoodby Island, Washington, listening to Talk 1090 in Seattle. Hey, Wendy, what's up?
I feel that it is dangerous, or at least undermining, to have conversations in regards to Bush signing legislation to give himself wartime powers to stay in office past 2008.
Well, as I said, that was an April Fool's joke. But
I feel that was a really not a wise maneuver. Conversations create action. The Republicans have been doing this practice effectively.
Yeah.
And the conversations of Bush instituting these powers has been happening for a few years. And
well,
we
in
have
fact, Nixon had this conversation with Kissinger.
Power.
Yeah, Nixon had this conversation with Kissinger during Watergate. He said, can I declare a state of emergency, suspend elections, and suspend Congress? And Kissinger said, no! I mean, you can, but I'm not going to let you do it. Wendy, we got to take a break, but I thank you for the call. You make a good point and an important one. 45 minutes past.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. in the good old USA. Well, I'd just like to say, tomorrow's dreams are always coming true.
Welcome back, my friends. 10 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-440-8466. Our telephone number nationwide. 3 hours a day, 5 days a week, right here, TomHartman.com. If you want to drop into our live chat room, just click the live chat link and hang out with some of the finest minds on the entire Internet. Lisa in Indianapolis, Indiana. Hey, Lisa, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to ask, talking about Bush suspending elections, what's the likelihood of him doing that in 2006?
I think the likelihood of... I just don't think anybody's going to let him get away with it. You know, that's so beyond the pale. I mean, just this NSA wiretapping thing has got Republicans blowing back at him. I mean, they're still timid. They're still afraid of his power. They still realize that taking on George W. Bush is sort of like taking on the mafia. But no, I'm frankly not concerned about that. What I am concerned about is more Ken Blackwell style. And Republican National Committee style massive corruption of our electoral process. We had just in the last couple of weeks in New Hampshire, we had Republicans pleading guilty to slamming the Democratic phone banks on the get out the vote day for the election. So the Democrats lost that election by a very, very small margin. And had the phone banks been working, they probably would have won in at least a dozen states that we know of. During the 2004 election, there was a company that had been hired by the RNC that was setting up stands outside of strip malls, shopping centers, federal buildings, libraries, saying, would you like to register to vote? And if people checked the box saying that they wanted to register as a Democrat, their voting registration got torn up. So when they showed up to vote, their vote didn't get counted. We find now that over 305,000 voters were taken off the rolls in Ohio by Ken Blackwell in the year leading up to the 2004 election. The vast majority of them in districts, in cities and districts, specific counties that voted anywhere from 70 to 90% Democratic. And Bush only won by 64,000 votes in that state. He wouldn't be president if that vote fraud hadn't been done by Ken Blackwell. So that's the kind of thing that can, you know, not to mention, you know, machines that don't work and that can be easily hacked and rigged. That's the stuff that concerns me, frankly, a whole lot more than Bush trying to do an absolute power grab. Makes sense?
Yeah.
Thanks a lot, Lisa. Good to hear from you. Terry in Rushton, Louisiana. Hey, Terry, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom. I'm just concerned over here. There have been a lot of, very Christian-oriented right-wing radio stations that have kind of spread all across the central part of America. I'm 25 years old, and this didn't happen 10 years ago. My concern is, are there the Christian right, do they share some of the same fiscal beliefs that the corporate right kind of do? Do they advocate the low taxes, those sort of things?
Is there a
marriage between the two?
Yeah, what you're seeing is really two things at once, Terry. First of all, with regard to the rise of Christian broadcasting, and, you know, for example, in Phoenix, Air America was off the air for a couple of weeks. Today they're back on because the station they were on got bought out by a Christian broadcaster. That wasn't part of some grand conspiracy. That was simply a testimonial to the fact that Christian broadcasting is one of the most profitable forms of broadcasting out there. It's just, you know, it's a money machine. And Christian bookselling. I mean, you know, the Left Behind books outsell every...
Oh,
Tim LaHaye is the biggest selling book author in the world.
Left Behind?
Yeah.
I really think some of these Christians really, really want the rapture to come.
Oh, yeah, they do. And there's something like 40 million copies of that book in print, or those books. I mean, it's incredible. So number one, the Christianity has become a major industry in the United States. Mega churches, publishing, radio, television. Pat Robertson invested $70 way back when to get on the air on a little UHF station and turned that into an empire that's now worth over $1 billion.
They are on the Family Channel. When I flip through, the 700 Club is on five different times during the day.
Yeah.
And those other little Christian stations I was referring to drain out NPR. I think they specifically put those stations right next to the NPR station on the dial to where I can't listen to my Delta Blues, you know, on Saturday night.
Sure.
They think
they're doing the Lord's work. I mean, you know, it's that simple. Now, what Kevin Phillips documents in his book, American Theocracy, is that the religious Reich and the corporate Reich have formed an unholy alliance. Now, he doesn't draw the parallels between the same thing happening in Germany, but I will, and other countries as well, by the way. And I think that this is, frankly, very dangerous. It's you know, it's interesting. In the early days of this republic, James Madison and Thomas Jefferson were both supporters of the First Amendment provision mm-hmm. that there shall be no, you know, no interference with religion and no official religious state.
You're correct on that. They also really didn't want a state neither.
Right, but there was a difference in the reason why they said that, Terry. And Madison was concerned that if government started giving money to religion, it would ultimately corrupt religion, and religion would become basically just another business and another political arm of the government. Jefferson was concerned that if religious folks infiltrated into government, they could turn our government into a theocracy. Both of them were convinced the other was wrong. In other words, Jefferson thought, it'll never happen that government will give money to religions. That's, you know, nobody's going to be that stupid. Like Bush gave $1 billion to the churches last year. And Madison was like, you know, no government made up of, you know, no representative people, the voters, will not allow religious zealots to run for political office and win. And it turns out that they were both right and they were both wrong, and therefore so much more of the tragedy. Jerry in Olympia, Washington. Jerry, we just have a few seconds left.
Well, then I probably won't be able to do this. I'll just sit back and listen, Tom.
Okay, Jerry, give us a call in the next hour or the one after that. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. I thought from the note here from the call screener that maybe you had a quick comment. But I do appreciate it. Kevin Phillips' book, American Theocracy, an amazing read. And I've spent the last couple of days with it. And I just tell you, this guy has nailed it. And, you know, he's still a Republican as far as I can tell, but it's still a brilliant, brilliant book. Although he'll have nothing to do with the Bushes. You know, his last book was trashing the Bush dynasty, as it were. It's 57 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. We'll be back after the news at the top of the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Covers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
I have never told my own religion, nor scrutinized that of another, wrote Thomas Jefferson in 1816 in a letter to Mrs. Harrison Smith. He went on to say, I never attempted to make a convert, nor wish to change another's creed. I am satisfied that yours must be an excellent religion to have produced a life of such exemplary virtue and correctness. For it is in our lives and not in our words that our religion must be judged. Thomas Jefferson, our quote for the day. And when we look at the impact of religion, and we look at also the state of things in America right now, the safety nets, for example, for children in the United States versus other countries. Some you know, truly startling numbers here. Some truly startling numbers. Without government tax and transfers, for example, France and the U.S. would both have 25% of their children in poverty. In France, government action has slashed that figure to 6.5%. In the U.S., government policy reduces the figure only marginally to 21.5%. As just one of many examples, and they continue on. And in just a moment, I believe we're going to have with us Rick Scarborough. Yeah, there we go. Okay, and we can put him on the air. Hey, Rick Scarborough, a Vision for America, visionamerica.org, the website, the book Liberalism Kills Kids, Rick?
That's right, Tom. Good to talk with you.
Good to talk with you, too. There's something that I don't get here. I could certainly see a book titled, I Don't Like Your Lifestyle, you know, Why Don't You Live Mine, or something like that. But, you know, you talk about killing children. The United States, under conservative economic policies, our poverty, our childhood poverty in the United States, has risen beyond any other industrialized nation.
Sound like you're now the co-author of that book.
I beg your pardon?
you and I should co-author that book. That's a subject that perhaps deserves some attention, but liberalism certainly, and I don't say liberals, I say the philosophy of liberalism certainly is killing kids.
Well, what do you believe is the philosophy of liberalism, Rick Scarborough?
The whole idea of progressivism originating, even though many...
What does that mean?
Well, it means for me that we start with the premise of man rather than God. If God exists, he is subordinated in many liberals' minds to the state or to personal achievement. And the result of the philosophy of liberalism has advanced more through the courts and academia than through the public, through the people of
Rick, speaking as a Christian and as a liberal, I have to say I think that what you're describing is secularism, not liberalism.
Well, I would apply to
and it's even a small slice of secularism. I mean,
let me ask you a question, Tom. Do you believe in abortion?
Believe?
Do you believe in abortion?
Do you believe in abortion, Rick?
Well, let me rephrase that so we're going to pick at words here. Do you believe that a woman should have the right to kill a baby in her womb if she chooses to?
Do you believe that four cells inside a woman are a baby, Rick?
So you're not going to answer the question.
No, I'm asking you, do you believe that four cells are a baby?
A child is originated at the time of conception. From that point forward, to stop a baby from being fully developed and delivered, you have to kill it. And I believe that that's morally wrong. Now, the agenda that advances that is liberalism, and that kills one-third of the children conceived in America.
That's assuming that you consider four cells a
child. I do.
I do, and I don't, and that's the difference between us. So I would say, no, I absolutely think, I have to say, Rick, I will go on the record as saying I think it's absolutely wrong to kill a child. I think it's absolutely wrong to kill a viable fetus. Absolutely. But four cells, I don't have a problem with that.
Well,
and that's the difference between you and me, is you believe those four cells are a child, and I believe those four cells are four cells.
Well, do you believe a child at 3 months in the development in the womb should be killed?
Now we're getting into the gray area where I think that you people can really have a reasonable discussion about this, and this is the discussion that Americans should be having. But I also suggest to you, that's a discussion that a woman should be having with her doctor, her priest, her pastor, her own conscience, and her own conscience and her own God. Rick, you and I are both Christians. Let's just look for a moment at the fundamentals of Christianity and liberalism. Matthew 25. In Matthew 25, Jesus, this in my mind, this is the heart of Christianity. Matthew 25 in the Sermon on the Mount, but in particular Matthew 25. And in Matthew 25, as I'm sure you're familiar, the students of Jesus the came to him and said, you know, how do we get into heaven? And he said, in the last day, you know, I'm going to be separating the sheep from the goats. Those who are going to heaven and those who are going to hell. And he said, and those who are going to heaven, the sheep, they're going to be the ones who fed me when I was hungry, who clothed me when I was naked, who visited me when I was in prison, who took care of me when I was sick. And the disciples are freaked out because he's never been sick, he's never been hungry, he's never been in prison, and he's never been naked. And they're like, well, you've never had, you know, we have never had an opportunity to provide those things to you. How can we get to heaven if that's what we have to do? And he says, as you do unto the least of my brethren, you do to me. And I would submit to you, Rick Scarborough, that conservatism is killing children in the United States, because conservatism in the United States is driving up infant mortality. Conservatism in the United States is driving up poverty. Conservatism in the United States is making life progressively more miserable for the working people of the United States. And that is leading to the death and the abuse of progressively more and more children.
Tom, did you invite me to this interview to dress me down or for us to exchange ideas? I mean, you're lobbying. You won't let me speak.
Go for it, Rick.
Conservative Christians, and I consider myself one of those, I contribute better than 10% of my gross income to the cause of Christ every single year. I'm involved.
Christ said to give everything you have.
Oh, everything I have. Yeah,
apparently, you don't intend to make it into heaven, Rick.
Everything that I have was tithed on before I got it. And the fact of the matter, when I leave, I'll leave an estate partially divided among the works of Christ. I do give to the poor. I do visit the hungry. And I don't deny anything that you just said, but I also remind you that Jesus said, for whosoever believes in him hath life, and he that does not have life, but the wrath of God remains on him. And so the heart of the gospel is knowing Christ, and knowing Christ means that you embrace his whole agenda, including that which feeds the poor, and I do. killing babies.
Rick, every day, 2019 babies are born into poverty. And Rick, are you going to filibuster me now?
If I have to, I'd be glad to. I can.
I just don't think it's going to work, you know, if we both do that.
Well,
every day in America, 2019 babies are born into poverty. What would you
every
do about
day,
that?
Every day, thousands are aborted before they get a chance to be born.
And we have already agreed, Rick, that you and I have a difference of opinion on the abortion issue, and we're not going to resolve that, and we're not going to change America on that issue. Now, let's move on, because you're talking about liberalism killing children, not fetuses.
What is the number one cause
and I'm saying
the number one
that
cause of poverty? What is the number one cause of poverty in America in your mind, Tom?
I would say the economic policies of this government.
Yeah, I would say unwed motherhood. Liberalism for decades now has taught have sex anywhere, anytime, anyhow, with anyone you please. And the devil...
You know, Rick, I don't know a single... I proudly, ever since 1968, when I saw... 67, when I saw the light, and I worked for Barry Goldwater's campaign in 64, and in 68 I saw the light. I've been a liberal for a long, long time, and to the best of my knowledge, I have never heard anybody say that. Come on, you're making cartoon characters out of people.
I tape-recorded a young lady saying that.
George Washington was a liberal. He said, I hope I shall ever see America become more liberal. Thomas Jefferson was a liberal. The founders of this country were liberals. This nation is founded on the liberal principles of John Locke and Rousseau. And for you to make cartoon characters out of this, it's tragic, Rick.
Liberalism has generated a whole 70% of the babies in America now are born out of wedlock. That's 80% in Black America. No fault divorce. All of these policies that have produced this decadence.
And I would submit to you, Rick, that in those neighborhoods, if people had decent jobs, that you would not see that. The best anti-poverty program is a job. And conservative policies, particularly by demagoguing issues like abortion and the so-called war on Christians and so on, are diverting our attention from the real issue, which is that we are being ripped off.
Have you read my book?
I have not.
But you're attacking it.
I am not attacking your book. I'm having a conversation with you.
but the fact of the matter is, the policies of liberalism advanced in this country, for instance, the First Amendment, has been twisted by the courts to say that I cannot acknowledge Jesus Christ at Christmas, but you say God's name.
You certainly can, Rick. What the courts have said is that government cannot.
Well,
you're welcome to all you want. You just did.
Our founding fathers all acknowledge God. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal and endowed by their Creator. That's acknowledging God.
Sure. That doesn't mean that we have a national religion. There's also the First Amendment.
There is no national church.
Rick Scarborough. We've been talking with Rick Scarborough. His book, Liberalism Kills Kids, his website, visionamerica.org. Rick, good talking to you.
Thank you, Tom.
You give as good as you get. I appreciate it.
See you.
16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, let's see, the founders of this. Ben Franklin, quote, I have found Christian dogma unintelligible. Early in life, I absented myself from Christian assemblies. He was a deist and arguably an early Unitarian. Thomas Jefferson, on February 1st, 1799, wrote in his personal diary about George Washington. He said, when the clergy addressed General Washington on his departure from the government, it was observed in their consultation that he had never, on any occasion, said a word to the public which showed a belief in the Christian religion, and they thought that they should so pen their address as to force him, at length, to declare publicly whether he was a Christian or not, and they did so. However, Jefferson noted in his diary, the old fox was too cunning for them. He answered every article of their address without, particularly, except that which he passed over without notice. Washington never did, I'm quoting Thomas Jefferson here, Washington never did say a word on the subject of Christianity in any of his public papers except in his valedictory letter to the governors of the states and when he resigned his commission in the Army, wherein he speaks of the benign influence of the Christian religion. I know the Governor Morris, who pretends to be in his secrets in Washington's confidence and believes himself to be so, has often told me that General Washington believes no more in that fundamentalist Christian system than he himself did. In fact, it was George Washington who supervised the language of the treaty with Tripoli, which starts out, as the government of the United States is not in any sense founded on the Christian religion. And you know, on it goes. This, you know, as I said, this is a debate that goes back a long, long way. But the founders, many of the founders, were strong, religious, God-fearing men. And others among them were not. And the clear consensus was that religion could be a force that could destroy America, turn us back into a theocracy, as they were seeing happen in Massachusetts, or could ennoble America if it was kept out of government. And that's what these new theocrats want, is they want to bring it into government. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service on the line. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom. Well, the rumor certainly being circulated by CNN is that Scott McClellan and Treasury Secretary John Snow will be the next people to go on the chopping block.
Yeah, I saw that this morning. What makes sense. I mean, John Snow, the economy's not doing well, so you fire the Treasury Secretary. Bush is tanking in the polls, and you want the myth to be well believed that it's because he's not getting his message out, so you fire the guy who delivers his message.
Right, and yet the economy, the polls are showing that most people think the economy is poor. So I think what they may be ticked off about is that despite the economy, he's not able to get a message out that it's a good economy. And Scott McClellan, maybe he's some kind of ritual sacrifice, because if indeed Josh Bolton, the new White House chief of staff, wants to improve communications, I don't think you'd do that by bringing in Dan Bartlett, the White House counselor, who we're hearing is who he's thinking of bringing in. Scott McClellan has a relatively cordial relationship with the press.
Hmm. Yeah. And Dan Bartlett?
Well, Bartlett is a fairly congenial guy, but he's, you know, he's up to his neck in protecting the president no matter what. When it came to the whole Bush and the military thing, he was very, very involved in making sure that no information became available or got out that was going to be damaging to their position.
Yeah. Now, Do you see this, Victoria Jones? I mean, you have the cat's eye, or the cat, what's the catbird view, or I forget the phrase, but the old cliche.
Catbird seat.
Yeah, catbird seat. Thank you. There in Washington D.C. I mean, you're inside in the White House during the press conferences. You know a lot of these people. Do you see this house cleaning or housekeeping or this change in the staff as, number one, the obligatory thing that's coming from pressure from Republican consultants and Republican members of Congress who are scared to death that if Bush doesn't get his act together, they're going to go down in flames, number one. Or number two, as George Bush actually deciding to change direction or reasserting authority in the White House. Or number three, as some indication of an actual change in policy in the White House.
I don't see it as a change in policy. But if they are considering firing Scott McClellan, this tells me that what this is about is changes in perception. They don't think that their message, which they believe in because they've drunk the Kool-Aid, they don't think that their message is getting out. I don't believe this means a change in policy at all. Whether President Bush is involved in this, he may be ticked off enough that he thinks his message isn't getting out. On the other hand, his interactions with the public recently have been very positive. He enjoyed his press conference with the media. He may well feel that he is getting his message out.
Hmm. Which means what for future U.S. policy? It's just more of the same, basically. In other words, he thinks that everything's fine.
The
bubble boy is happy in his bubble.
I believe so. I don't think it means any major change in U.S. policy. The most recent change we saw was the minuscule shift where the White House decided that in the speeches Bush, most recent speeches Bush was giving, that he had to explain more to us about Iraq rather than just tell us he was right.
Right.
Now, that's not a change in policy.
No, no, it's not. It's just a change in strategy, or PR
right.
strategy at that. Victoria Jones, TalkRadioNews.com, Talk Radio News Service. Victoria, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
Great speaking with you. 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartmann Radio Program.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartmann.
Dead from Kansas on the windswept plains. For dead from Miami, for dead from Tennessee. For dead from the neighborhood of Hollis, Queens. For dead from Tallahassee, for dead from Mass. For dead from Tegreen.
And welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartmann here with you. The Tom Hartmann Radio Program. Truth in Broadcasting for a Change. 1-866-440-8466-440-THOM, our telephone number. David in Blaine, Washington. Hey, David, what's in your mind?
Hey, Tom, great to talk to you again. You know, this Rich Scarborough character that you were sparring with, and other so-called pro-life fundamentalist Christians are acting more like demagogues that rather than Christians. Would you say?
Well, you know,
I
wouldn't disagree with that. I don't think that name-calling is really the solution to anything. I think that they're wrong. If you want to take a completely biblical view of this, for example, nowhere in the Bible does it say that a baby is a baby until birth. In fact, it says in the Bible in several different places that it becomes human after it takes its first breath.
Right. I didn't mean to name-call either, but they
for
continue
example.
To frame this phony argument about abortion. I mean, what woman in their right mind enjoys getting an abortion if it gets to that level? Plus,
No, it's like, what person in their right mind wants to have a tooth pulled?
That's right. It's a medical procedure, for crying
yeah.
out loud. I mean, but as a spiritual Christian myself, I mean, it's my understanding that the soul, which they fail to mention in their arguments about pro-life, I feel the most important part of the human body and our own personal source of life, from the Creator, does not enter the body until and into physicality until the human body is ready, which is 9 months. And so for them to hyper-focus on protecting the physical body, and guaranteeing that it gets born, and then after it's born, it's like the human body is on its own. Exactly.
You're on your
go
own.
Go to Iraq, and go kill yourself,
Yeah.
We don't care.
Yeah. No, you're spot on right, and it's, that... It's well
so,
said.
I
do think these guys are demagoguing the issue, and they're doing it for a simple reason. It drives up the fundraising to their programs.
That's
the more
fine.
The more the books they can sell, the more that they can run out, send out emails going, we're under attack, please send $25. These guys are, creating multi-million-dollar empires.
Well, what they need to do is find a desert island somewhere, take Bush and Cheney and Rumsfeld with them, and go have their little war on terror and their World War IV.
Yeah.
And leave
us
out of it.
Yeah, let's give them Grenada or something. Actually, I think they wanted Iraq. But in fact, why don't we just give them Iraq? We'll just, they can even have all the oil. David, I got to move along. Thanks for the call.
Tom.
Good point. I appreciate it. Curtis in Flaxville, Montana. Hey, Curtis.
Hey, Tom. How's it going?
Great, but I'll get better. What's up?
Well, I'm a Lutheran pastor, and I agree about most of what you said concerning the religious right. And I'm deeply concerned by it. I have been for a long time.
And by the way, I salute you. You're that was my father's church. He's Norwegian and
sure.
Although I was largely raised in the Methodist Church, which is a different thing. But in any case, I'm certainly familiar with the Lutheran Church, and Martin Luther. In fact, I've been to the church where he it wasn't Coburg. That was where he hid out. Where he nailed the
mm-hmm.
things on the wall.
Sure.
But in any case, I think that there are a lot of Christians in the United States, and I readily identify myself as a Christian. I think that there are a lot of Christians in the United States who would, if asked, say these guys like Scarborough don't represent me.
Right.
I don't even think they represent Christianity or the teachings of Christ.
Right.
And yet, there's no anger in that, frankly. There's no vitriol in that. And I don't have a multi-million dollar organization cranking out emails and letters to people saying, you know, oh, we're under attack by these, you know, and there's no money to be made in it. So they end up getting all the press and all the PR and being flogged on Fox. What do you think Christians, and for that matter, you know, people of good faith and goodwill, regardless of religion or spirituality, do?
Well, I think for one thing that they ignore certain basic things like the problems of the poor. I've worked in the inner city in Chicago. I have the honor of serving in an African-American church there. And the problems that we have are just enormous.
Yeah.
The problems out here on the prairie about the corporations taking up the farms are incredible. The family farm is dying. Folks need, well, in my view, I mean, I'm here to preach a gospel. In my view, people need the gospel. They don't need some drivel about how the government is for them and how, and some moral precepts about how they're going to survive based on what the president or some corporation says.
Yeah, well, and in fact, if you look at, for example, France and the United States, both of us have significant unemployment problems.
Right.
Both of us have a large, you know, potential poverty problems. Both of us have large populations of people who are the victims of discrimination. In France, it's largely immigrants from Africa. In the United States, it's former African American, you know,
right.
former slaves, African Americans. And there are a lot of parallels there. And both countries, if France had our economic system, and including our welfare system, much maligned as it is, both countries would have around 25% rates of childhood poverty, which is what we have in the United States.
Oh, of course, yeah.
In France, it's 6.5%. The 18 countries, the 18 fully developed countries looked at, child poverty was at least halved by government welfare measures. Eight countries, Austria, Belgium, Denmark, Finland, Luxembourg, Norway, Sweden, and Switzerland, have succeeded in keeping child poverty rates below 5%. And
right.
yet they are all competitive, they are all industrialized, they are all, you know, capitalist, democratic nations. 18 industrialized nations, the survey of 18 industrialized nations draws a poverty line at 50% of each country's median income. And so, you know, we're comparing apples to apples here. And yet in the United States, with one out of five of our children living below poverty, we have the highest child poverty rate in the industrialized world. Only four other countries in the industrialized world have child poverty rates of more than 10%, those being Australia, Canada, Ireland, and Israel, who all have relatively conservative policies, and none of those are above the low teens, and yet we're in the 20s. I mean, this is anti-Christian.
Right.
This is not what Jesus would say. I mean, the number of Americans living in poverty has grown. 37 million people in 2005. That's one out of every eight people in the United States.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, I think that you have to look at things like Katrina, the family farm, the inner city, and things like that. And, well, racism, I mean, we see it here on the reservations, and see what's going on and see the need, at least. I mean, I'm looking at it from a pastoral perspective, okay? The need for the gospel in that sense, the need to uplift those and give them lives of dignity instead of this pablum of God helps those that helps themselves that is nowhere in the Bible.
Right. No,
but
that's
it's
no,
about
that,
it.
It's Ben Franklin times. Said that, actually.
Right, yeah.
In Poor
yeah.
Richard's Almanac.
Right.
Curtis, I respectfully submit to you that those in America in need of the gospel are the people in the corporate boardrooms and the people.
Oh, I would agree. Yeah.
You know, because they're.
I couldn't
they're,
agree more.
They are not reading
right.
the same Bible that you and I have read.
Right.
Curtis, thanks a lot for the call.
Oh,
it's
thanks,
great to
Tom.
Hear from you. I appreciate
Take care
it.
Now.
Yep. Rick in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hey, Rick, what's on your mind today?
Well, I, too, was struck by your little subject there, Mr. Scarborough, and I guess I had a couple questions I'd throw out there and let you maybe expound on them if you would. And number one is, why is it that whenever you talk to a real fundamentalist type of Christian, like he seemed to be, they always seem to think that political conservatism and Christianity go hand in hand? And the second part of that is, and he kind of just alluded to it, maybe you didn't pick up on it, where he said that man is exalted above God and liberalism. Now, what they usually mean by that is that liberals tend to want to ameliorate some of the social ills, and I guess these folks would say that it's kind of a Calvinist idea, you know, where the poor are poor because they
God ordained it, and the rich are rich because God ordained that too, and just leave it alone. Don't try to. But then he kind of contradicted himself too when he said that he did try to help the poor, and I guess I just don't know what these people are.
Well, no, he said he ties 10% of his income. It may well be to his own church.
Oh,
you know, look at Barbara Bush gave a big donation too.
Oh.
And ended up with her son. I'm not, you know, and that may well be a cheap shot. I mean, Rick Scarborough may really and truly be, you know, devoting 10% of his income to programs that really and truly help the poor. But my experience of Christian conservatives, right wing Christian conservatives, has been that by and large that's not the case. And in fact, on the three occasions in that conversation where I tried to redirect the discussion to essentially the teachings of Jesus, which were by and large about poverty,
yes,
he wanted to take it back to abortion.
Have you ever met a religious conservative who was a political liberal? I actually knew one who was a lay minister from Australia, and he was actually a Calvinist, but he was also a socialist.
Yeah.
And I asked him how he could be that way. He says, well, I just think socialism is more effective at dealing with poverty. So there was an honest answer from a...
Oh, I've met a number of them. One of them was John Paul II.
That's a good point. the most prominent, obviously.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. And he has spoken out loudly and repeatedly. Well, he's gone now, but he spoke out loudly and repeatedly on behalf of the poor and against an economic system in the United States that enhances poverty. And against, I would add, the Iraq War as well.
Well, wasn't it interesting that whenever a pope, any pope, is, for instance, and I'm talking about the conservative response to a pope, keeps to the anti-abortion stance, which almost all of them will, or all of them have, but whenever they talk about ameliorating poverty, then people like William Buckley get a little bit upset.
Yeah, well, and then they don't. That's not the part that they show on the CNN special, though. His attacks on George W. Bush, his attacks on the war in Iraq, his attacks on poverty in the United States, his support of the labor movement, those are not the parts that you're going to see on CNN. Rick, thanks for the call.
Thank
Good
you.
To hear from you. We've got to take a break here. One in five children is poor during the first 3 years of life in the United States. This is the time of greatest brain development. This is when it's critical to give kids the greatest resources. Where are the Christians on this? 45 minutes past.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Come heed me, good brothers, come hear one and all. Don't brag about standing or you'll surely fall. You're shining your light and shine it you should. But you're so heavenly minded, you're no earthly good.
And welcome back, my friends.
No earthly good you are.
50
no
minutes past the hour,
good.
Coming up on 9 minutes before
you're
the top
so
of the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live all across the United States. Storm, listening on WINI in Carbondale, Illinois. Hey, Storm, what's on your mind today?
Thanks, Tom. Tom, on the issue of the invasion of illegal immigrants to our country, it seems that our two senators, Dick Durbin and Barack Obama, are preparing to betray us by joining Junior Bush in allowing these people, the workers, the guest workers permit, which is nothing more than amnesty. And I say that because these guys are making comments like, we are a nation of immigrants, and all those nonsensical comments that these people make.
Yeah.
So I think it's time for the people of this great state of Illinois to call their senators and let them know how we feel about this issue. In fact, it wouldn't hurt for people from other states to call these guys as well. That's Dick Durbin and Barack Obama.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you. And although I have to tell you, Storm, it's not just limited to Illinois. And by the way, the toll-free number for Congress is 888-355-3588. More and more, initially the Democrats figured, okay, this is a battle between Republicans. We'll just step back, stay out of the way, and let them beat each other up, you know, and all that kind of thing. Now Democrats are being called out on it. What's your position going to be? So many Democrats seem to be pandering to what they hope will be a Democratic Hispanic vote, just like so many unions are hoping to get new members from these folks. And what they do, you know, and what everybody is missing is David Ricardo's Iron Law of Wages. You know, Ricardo wrote this back in 1814, and he said that whenever there is a surplus of labor, even a very small surplus of labor, wages will drop to a subsistence level. Wages will drop to the point where people have, you know, nothing other than the basic necessities of life. And that's the world that we're being taken to by these folks. And you're absolutely right. And the Democrats have no spine on this. They frankly don't have a take on it. They don't have a coherent take on it.
Well, I want these two senators and all the others to think that way, to know that people like myself and everybody in my group are going to work as hard as we can to defeat them in the next election should they betray us on this very important issue.
Well, here's the problem, Storm. You going to defeat them with a Republican?
Well, that's a good question, Tom, but there are going to be some independents running. There's a Green candidate running, and I guess I'll have to go with the Green candidate.
Well, they're not going to have a chance. Here's my... And in fact, you know, it'll be like my vote for Nader in 2000. I might as well have voted for George W. Bush, except that I was in Vermont, which was a green state, which was my personal rationalization. But nonetheless, I've learned my lesson from that. And I really think that although we can threaten them with "I'll not vote for you," I think the most important thing really is, rather than calling up our elected members of Congress, you know, the House and Senate, and basically saying, if you don't do this, I'm going to, you know, whack you upside the head, we should be educating them. They're supposed to be representing us. They're supposed to be doing what our will is. And we need to be saying, this is our will. These are our concerns. This is our position on these things. You know, please pass it along. You know, let the senator know. That we don't want the American labor force further diluted. We don't want it diluted by international trade agreements like NAFTA and GATT. That cause our American workers to have to compete with Chinese workers, and we don't want it diluted by illegal workers being brought into the United States to do those jobs that can't be exported, like, you know, the construction trades and working in restaurants and on and on and on. Neither one of these two categories of work, those that are exportable and those that are not exportable, in both cases, we don't want our labor force diluted so that, you know, the unions are busted and the minimum wage doesn't get raised and the American workforce continues to collapse. I got an email the other day from a guy saying, oh, you're completely nuts on this. All we have to do is raise the minimum wage. Well, come on. The minimum wage isn't a leader. It's a follower. When the minimum wage is raised, it's because everybody else has already raised their wages. It's an acknowledgement of reality. And, you know, just like the Supreme Court doesn't lead, it follows. You know, in 1954 in Brown versus Board of Education, they were reflecting the will of the people. In 73 with Roe v. Wade, they were reflecting the will of the people. People have to get that, you know, we have an economic system here that the more labor is diluted, whether it's by offshoring and exporting or whether it's by importing cheap labor, the more labor is diluted, the more solidly the price of labor is going to be kept down, including the minimum wage. And so, you know, there's not a simple solution other than saying enough already. Some protectionism. Yes, I'm a protectionist. I will say it right up front, because we that's how we built this nation for 200 and some odd years.
That's what we have a government for, is to give us some protection.
There you go. So, Storm, that would be my message to my senators. And it has been. I had, you know, my Senator Ron Wyden, my Democratic senator, I had him on my radio program last week and had this conversation with him. And I said, you know, I disagree with you. This is how I think. And he's like, oh, that's interesting. And I think the more we can have these conversations with these folks, the better, rather than just, you know, I think when we call them up and say, you know, I'm really angry and I'm not going to vote for you and I'm going to work for you, you know, that at that point that they automatically discount the call. You know, there's a certain, oh, this is the angry fringe kind of thing. We need to be, I think, having an intelligent dialogue with these folks.
Okay, Tom, so I won't smack them on the head.
Yeah, but be emphatic. I mean, you know, I think it's wonderful that you're going to be calling them, Storm, and I thank you for doing that.
Thanks, Tom.
Yeah, good talking with you, and thanks for listening to us there in WINI. One of our longest affiliates, one of our very first affiliates back, almost 3 years ago, I think, in Carbondale, Illinois. And once again, the telephone number for those of you inclined for Congress, for both the House of Representatives and the United States Senate, and the White House, for that matter. This is the Capitol Hill switchboard. If you have free long distance, it's 202-225-3121. That's the main number. And a toll-free number that you can use is 888-355-3588. 888-355-3588. And, of course, our number, 1-866-440-8466. TomHartmann.com. If you want to drop into our live chat room, click live chat and join us. Say hi. We'll be back after the news at the top of the hour. Tom Hartmann broadcasting live from the studios of The Quake in San Francisco today. I'll be back in Oregon tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from coast to coast on Sirius Satellite Radio, etc. Welcome back. The race to the bottom. While worldwide worker surplus and uncontrolled free trade are sinking American living standards, Alan Tonelson is with us on the line. Alan, welcome to the program.
Well, thanks very much for having me, Tom.
I finished reading your book yesterday on a flight from L.A. to San Francisco.
Mm.
And first of all, this is a book that was published, 6 years ago?
It was published in 2000, and then it came out in paperback with a brand new introduction in 2002.
Oh, okay. I have the hardcover, so I don't
okay.
have the brand new introduction. But 174 pages. I was able to read it on two flights.
Wow.
It was...
I hope you weren't skimming now.
No, I wasn't.
Okay.
And in fact, as I look at it, I see I've probably got about 50 pages here where I've dog-eared the corners and marked up things. This is one of the most dense, solid, well-done, powerful, articulate refutations of Thomas Friedman and the religion that has formed around him that I have ever seen, even though I don't think you ever mentioned Friedman's name specifically in the book.
I did talk a little. Well, first of all, thank you very, very much. That's extremely head-swelling praise, and I'll try not to let it to get to me too much. But I did mention Friedman's first book, The Lexus and the Olive Tree, which it seems to me is virtually identical to this latest book about the flat world.
Right.
And as I think you've been suggesting, it's just an uncritical hymn to a specific type of globalization that, in my view, has been absolutely disastrous, not only for American working people, but for the whole cause of maintaining a strong manufacturing base here in this nation, which is where it really counts, with all of the manifold social benefits that flow from that, the incredibly important national security benefits that flow from that, because we still fight wars with goods and not services, by and large. We still fight wars, by and large, with manufactured goods, and that's incredibly important. And what he doesn't mention, or what he refuses to acknowledge, is that this form of big corporation-driven globalization is creating a looming disaster for the entire global economy. And the sign of that are these unprecedented trade and economic imbalances that we're experiencing today.
Yeah, we're speaking with Alan Tonelson. His website, AmericanEconomicAlert.org, and his book, The Race to the Bottom, an absolutely brilliant piece of work. You've got to get this book. It's brilliant. And Alan, let's go back to, like, you know, the beginning, 101.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Why do people form themselves into nation states? Because this is the answer to this is the absolute refutation of Friedman's "the world is flat. Oh, we really don't need nation states. We just need multinational corporations."
Absolutely. And before we focus too tightly on Friedman, I do feel obligated to say that this vision that he's been sketching is one that is held by many, many very important constituencies on the right. Strangely enough, because we always think of the right as being rather nationalistic, but it's also held very, very strongly by certain constituencies of the left.
Oh, there's an absolute agreement on these things between, for example, Barack Obama and Bill Frist.
Exactly.
Between Bill Clinton and George W. Bush.
That's exactly right. And there's been a bipartisan policy failure that's been unfolding for roughly 20 years. But I think,
and in fact, I would say the last national figure to seriously take this on was Ross Perot, and he was characterized as a crazy old coot, although he got almost 20% of the vote. So at least Americans in their gut knew that there was something there.
Right, and they responded to him in an outpouring of support that we haven't seen for a third party candidate really since the early. I guess since Roosevelt ran in, when was it, 1912?
Yeah.
So
it's Teddy Roosevelt. Bull Moose Party, yeah.
Exactly.
And in fact, he swung an election with that.
Right. And he was an economic nationalist, by the way.
That's right. He was a populist. So back to the original question.
Right. Why do people form nation states?
They form
it first and foremost because it's been the most efficient means of providing them with the security in their day-to-day lives that they crave. Now, until very recently, the overwhelming focus has, of course, been military security. Now we've had, I'd say, in the last maybe 10, since the end of World War II, where you could even date it back to the start of the New Deal, there's been an increasing emphasis on economic security. Mm-hmm. And even though we remain in most respects a very strongly free market country, there has emerged a pretty strong consensus in this nation that some kind of welfare state has to exist to provide for those who simply can't. And that also reflects the second very important reason that people form nation states, and that is they do feel a sense of mutual obligation. In whatever political community they choose to create.
A sense of interdependence.
We're
in this together.
This is a
fundamental human instinct, I would say. It starts with family. It goes to clan or tribe or community or neighborhood, depending on the culture that you're in. And then it's expanded to the nation or the state and the nation. And it's a fundamental part of being human. We are a tribal animal, much like many other mammals.
That's right. And we seek to form communities for mutual gain and mutual support.
So in the face of this, how is it possible that folks like Friedman and Bill Clinton and intelligent people,
right.
and George W. Bush for that, not just him, I mean, he's the most recent, but I mean, his father, for example, the New World Order. How is it possible that these people would come along and say, let's replace that sense of community. Let's replace that shared security. Let's replace that interdependence that has, in various forms and incarnations and under a variety of different names, sustained the human race for over 100,000 years. Let's replace that with an international global rule run by an artificial entity called a corporation or a series of them to the benefit of those corporations and not to the benefit of the citizens. How did they possibly come up with this idea, number one, and number two, how can they possibly sell it?
Well, I think there's one more aspect to this, and that is they not only look to the private corporation as the main unit to which we all apparently ought to express our loyalty, they also look to international organizations. And I do think there is a sense that the nation state is either no longer entirely legitimate because we should be loyal instead, at least to some extent, to something called the world community, which is a phrase you hear and read over and over again in the mainstream media. And I think also there is a sense that because of all of the tremendous advances we've seen in transportation and communications, especially in the last roughly 10 or 15 years, that the nation state has become obsolete, and to remain loyal to it is a sign of in fact reaction. So I think that's one set of very strong ideas.
So they're portraying us as Luddites, basically.
Exactly.
So what's the how do you respond to that, Alan Thomason?
the way that you respond best of all, A, is by pointing out that this nation and its own constitutional system is entirely legitimate, and in so many respects we are still the envy of the world, and therefore it's obviously very effective. And in fact, one friend of mine points out that when we got attacked on 9/11, people were not flying the flags of Microsoft.
Right.
In their windows and on their front lawn. They were flying the stars and stripes, and there's a reason for this. Because
but what happens,
Microsoft wasn't going to take care of them.
Right, but what happens when the nation-state becomes taken over by the corporations within them? Isn't this just oligarchy revisited?
In lots of ways, yes, and in so many areas of our national life, we are seeing the privatization of systems and also institutions that had been public, and you do see the very upper-income group literally trying to wall itself off from the rest of us, and hoping to buy security and prosperity and safety. But they don't realize either that their own interests, in the long term anyway, are very bound up with the fate of this United States.
Right. And when we all go down, they're part of the all.
Absolutely.
The book, The Race to the Bottom, Why a Worldwide Worker Surplus and Uncontrolled Free Trade are Sinking American Living Standards by Alan Tonelson. Alan, thank you for being with us today.
My pleasure.
The website, AmericanEconomicAlert.org. It's 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
There's something wrong with the world today. I don't know what it is. Something's wrong with our eyes. We see things in a different way. God knows it ain't his. It sure ain't no surprise.
And welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. The Tom Hartman Radio Program, our number 1-866-440-8466. TomHartman.com if you'd like to drop into our live chat room and say hi to some of the finest minds on the whole entire Internet. Peggy in Burlington, Vermont, listening on WVAA. Hey, Peggy, welcome to the program.
Hi,
thank you,
Tom.
For calling.
I just get a little tired when I hear a whole lot of men discussing abortion and single motherhood. I know they... You know, there are a few single men out there being single parents, but this is something that's mostly about women. And I just think one of the things to be said about the so-called pro-life, I would call them mandatory motherhood people, is that there's no cheaper constituency than the fetus. Doesn't cost them a thing, does it? I mean,
right.
Because it's all in that woman's body. And I could be like Sojourner's Truth and say maybe this is an issue that's between women and God and that men have only a little bit to do with it. But, I just go crazy when I'm always hearing, and when I hear single mothers blamed for the moral decay in our country, single mothers, if nothing else, are the ones there with the children.
Right.
In many
right.
cases, they've been left, and in any case, they are the ones doing the job, raising the children with very little money. If we ever decided that motherhood was worth all that we like to say about it and actually honored it the way we honor everything else in this country by giving it money and a wage, a livable wage to do that work, we wouldn't have so much of a problem with it.
I agree, and other nations are doing that. Venezuela, for example, just recently acknowledged motherhood as a job. They changed their divorce laws so that failure to care for one of the children is grounds for divorce, and said that a woman at home taking care of the children, for that matter, a husband at home taking care of the children, a spouse at home taking care of the children, is earning into the national equivalent of the Social Security program at the same rate as a person working at the average
wage. Well,
that's
great, because it's insane what goes on here. And, I mean, if you've ever done it, you know it's one of the toughest jobs in the world.
Yeah, we have three children, and although my wife I am eternally grateful to her, bore probably the major brunt of raising our children, I participated in the process, certainly, and you know, to a large extent.
Yeah, but, and like I say, you know, there's nothing cheaper than to have the fetus for your constituency.
Yeah.
It doesn't cost you a thing.
And
we know from years of experience that the same people that vote, you know, anti reproductive rights for women are the same people who vote against the WIC program, who vote against every program that would actually help out, you know, children.
That's absolutely right. Yeah, you know, and for a long time, Peggy, on radio, on this program, actually, this program is 3 years old this month, and for the first year or so, whenever anybody would want to talk about abortion, I would simply say, hey, listen, I'm a man. I don't have a right to have an opinion. We're not going to discuss it on this show. And that, you know, in my opinion, only women should be allowed to vote if we're going to make abortion illegal or not, if we're going to decide that if it is a crime, you know, do women get the death sentence if they have an abortion, you know, blah, 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 all that stuff. That should, you know, only women should be allowed to vote on that because only women are affected by it directly. And, right. And you know, I held to that for a year and was able to kind of hold off the debate. But finally, I got it that at a certain level, it was a cop-out. I have to take these guys on. Mm-hmm.
Guess, you know, sometimes when it's a theological debate, it sounds like the angels on the head of a pin debate to a woman, yeah, who's dealing with the reality. And one of the things that's happened, because we have had legal abortion for the most part, although it's been chipped away at, is that we don't remember the stories of women floating up in the East River, which was something that brought doctors to the pro-choice struggle in the beginning, because they did remember that was happening then. Mm-hmm. And it isn't happening as much now because abortion has been available.
Oh, I was in high school in the 1960s when abortion was illegal. And I, you know, there was a girl in my high school, in my senior class, who one day just wasn't at school anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And it took a while for us to learn what had happened. She had gotten an illegal abortion, she'd gotten an infection, and she died of the infection.
And this is one more thing I want to say on the subject, and that is that pro-life ads have been able to get on the media, but there was a wonderful pro-choice ad made in New York where a woman was going shopping with 12 people in black robes shadowing her and telling her what to do in her every move. And that could not get on the air, as peace ads have not been able to get on the air, and as single-payer health care ads have not been able to get on the air. So I'm grateful for Air America for getting another perspective out there, but I, you know, people need to know there is only independent media. Everything else is a commercial.
Yeah, I don't disagree.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Peggy. Great to hear from you. I appreciate the call. All of the demagoguery around this issue is really one of the true tragedies in America. We do need a debate. We do need a discussion in this country about what it means to be moral as a nation. At what level should a nation behave morally? You know, what is the morality that is sufficiently universal that we can all agree on it? And frankly, I don't think it is, you know, whether or not abortion should be criminal or decriminalized. I think that it is, at what level are we willing to accept poverty among us? Do we really want to be the only country in the world with a poverty rate above 20% for our children? I mean, that seems to me a fundamental moral issue. At what level do we want to have people who work hard all their lives be able to have a decent job, a decent life, put their kids through school, have health care, and a decent retirement? This seems to me like a moral issue. You know, feeding the hungry, taking care of the sick, visiting those in prison. These are the moral issues. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
You may be an ambassador to England or France. You may like to gamble. You might like to dance. You may be the heavyweight champion of the world. You may be a socialite with a long string of pearls. But you're gonna have to serve somebody. Yes, indeed, you're gonna have to serve somebody.
And welcome back, my friends.
It may be the devil or it may be the Lord, but you're gonna have to serve somebody.
You tell him, Bob. Welcome back. 25 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-440-8466. Our telephone number, TomHartman.com. Going to drop into our live chat room. Time now for a Piggies Alert. I think. Can you play it, Alex? I'm not hearing it. No, it's not working. Okay, well, I'll tell you, we had some theme music for the Piggies Alert, which you've all heard before. So here's the Piggies Alert. Anyhow, the Labor Department's Wage and Hour Division is supposed to protect your most basic rights at work, right? I mean, this is the Wage and Hour Division of the Labor Department is the part of the Department of Labor that you go to if you feel like you've been taken advantage of with regard to your wages and hours. So George W. Bush has nominated a fellow by the name of Paul DeCamp to head up the agency. And if you go to Gibson, Dunn & Crutcher, a law firm that has among its clients Walmart, where Paul DeCamp works or worked, you find a bio that apparently makes him perfect for protecting us from worker violations, employer violations of the minimum wage, child labor laws, Family and Medical Leave Act, Migrant and Seasonal Agriculture Worker Protection Act, prevailing wage requirements under Davis-Bacon and all that kind of. Yeah, here's what he's done. This is from AFL-CIO.org, this summary, but it's essentially distilled from his bio, you know, what this guy has done. Now keep in mind, this is George W. Bush's nominee to head up the Wage and Hour Division of the Department of Labor. The guy who's representing you and me. He's our last line of defense. As a private practice lawyer, DeCamp represented Walmart in trying to prevent a class of 1.5 million women, the largest employment class action ever certified, from suing the company for discrimination in pay and promotions. He tried to stop women from suing Walmart. Remember the Walmart, the women? I believe it's still ongoing. He tried to stop that. He has proposed taking overtime pay away from workers in ways that are even more extreme than what the administration actually has done, and suggested easy outs for bosses who accidentally misclassify workers as not eligible for overtime pay. Among his clients, businesses opposing union organizing campaigns and fighting unfair labor practice charges. He has been a lawyer representing businesses who are fighting against you and me when we claim that there have been unfair labor practices or that we want to organize. He represented an employer, one of his clients was appealing a $40 million sexual harassment verdict. A jury had already found this company guilty and hit him with a $40 million fine, and he said, I'll help you out, and help them appeal that. And he's fought on the boss's sides on collective and individual actions involving the Employee Retirement Income Security Act, the Age Discrimination in Employment Act, the Americans with Disabilities Act, and the Fair Labor Standards Act, as well as state wage and hour laws. Always been on the boss's side. Always. The new director of the Wage Hour Division of the Department of Labor, Paul DeCamp. Thanks to George W. Bush. 1-866-440-8466. Armin in Bradenton, Florida. Hey, Armin, what's up?
Hey. I have three verses that Jesus said with quick answers.
Okay.
The first one is, Jesus said, teach my children how to fish. And the conservative said, move a fishing tackle factory overseas and fire the local workers.
Okay.
The second one said, Jesus said, feed my poor and hungry.
Right.
The conservative said, let's steal from the middle class while getting richer and give to the poor that won't work a free ride so they'll vote for us. And the third one and final one, Jesus said it's easier to put a camel through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to go to heaven. And the rich conservative said, hell, we'll just steal or buy heaven with junk bonds.
There you go. Okay.
Now, all these liberals out there that, quote, mean well, I mean, George Bush is doing what they want, really. Let's be honest. I mean, any country that's doing what this country's doing, okay, and they really got on Clinton when he was doing it, but they don't play fair with their boy Bush. That's why we think they're like a cult. And cults are a threat to society. And this is why. Because Bush is moving everything he can out of this country that's productivity, that creates wealth. He's moving it out of the country, and he's leaving the borders open and bringing in massive amounts of poverty. And don't you just know that that's going to be good for the future of the middle class?
Well, no, it's not, and that's the whole reason he's doing it. But it is going to be good for the future of the corporate boardrooms and the CEOs. Armin, thanks a lot for the call. It's always great to hear from you. Greg in San Antonio, Texas. Hey, Greg, what's up?
Hi. Oh, nothing. I've been having a debate about immigration, and the one thing everybody keeps coming up with is that, well, if you penalize the employees, you know, and then you'd see a run back to the border because no illegals would get hired, right?
I think if you penalize the employers.
I'm sorry. Yes, sir. Yeah. I'm sorry. I'm nervous. Mm-hmm. It's my first time calling, so. But they say, you know, people I talk to, they say, well, you know, what will happen is that you'll drive up the cost of labor, and then you'll increase.
That's true.
And you'll increase inflation, though. You know, all bread will be $5 a loaf or something like that. And I'm like, well, that can't be true because you have that going on, and you know, you have demand for workers in, you know, New Orleans right now, right?
Yeah. What your friends misunderstand is what inflation is. Inflation is not just the increase in prices. First of all, they're right. If we were to make it absolutely illegal with sufficient draconian penalties in the United States for employers to hire illegal aliens, probably half to two-thirds, maybe three-quarters, maybe four-fifths, who knows, of the illegal aliens in this country would leave, and the rest would begin a more normal process to acquire citizenship. Or they're, you know, relatives of people who are already citizens or whatnot. I mean, you know, there's a whole lot. First of all, you got to realize there's not just like one lump of illegal aliens who fit a particular profile, but many of them would leave, and that would mean that the demand for labor would increase, which would drive up the cost of labor, which would mean that paychecks would start rising. And as paychecks are rising, certainly the products that we're making, which are made with labor, are also going to increase in price. But number one, labor is only a small cost of any product, any finished product. Okay. You know, you buy a hamburger at McDonald's, labor is, you know, maybe 5 cents of it or 10 cents of it or 20 cents of it. You get a hotel room at Marriott, you know, whatever. I mean, you pick a product, you buy a TV, labor is a small portion of that. So if the cost of labor goes up, yes, the cost of goods and services are going to go up, but not by the same percentage. So the bottom line is, yes, you and I will see the cost of everything from food to TVs go up, say, 3 or 4%, but we'll see our paychecks go up 8 or 10%. And so, you know, that's fine with me. Now, is that inflation? No, it's not. Because inflation is when the value of the currency is reduced relative to the number of things it buys. Inflation is when the government prints more money than the wealth in the nation reflects, right? In other words, it used to be with the gold standard, for example, if you had $1 billion worth of gold, you had $1 billion worth of dollars out there that were convertible to gold. We don't have the gold standard anymore. So the theory is that, let's say we've got $1 trillion or $10 trillion worth of assets in the United States, you know, from our businesses to our homes to our cars to everything else. If we have $10 trillion worth of assets, just to pull a number out of the air, then we print $10 trillion. Now, if the government prints an extra $1 trillion and throws that into circulation, we now have $1 trillion worth of assets, but we have $2 trillion floating around, we have $10 trillion worth of assets, but we now have $11 trillion in circulation. What that means is that the value of every dollar has been decreased by 10%. And that will work its way into the marketplace. Inflation is created by government monetary policy, pure and simple and nothing else, or by and large. I mean, so yes, prices would go up and wages would go up, but it would not be inflation.
Okay.
So it's kind of an econ, you know, it's a subtle thing, you know, and most people don't get it. And I really appreciate, Greg, your calling and asking for clarification on that. It's a good one.
Thanks
a lot for the call. Phyllis in Sacramento, California. Hey, Phyllis, we have about 30 seconds left. You wanted to make a quick point?
I want to say that I think that the men in this country need to keep their mouths shut and their zippers zipped when it comes to choice.
Okay.
And I do want more time because I have some points I'd like to bring up. May I wait till the commercial?
We can try. What's the first point?
Well, I'd like to state that there was no law in this country until 1830 about against abortion, and the Christian Church followed in 1869. So all these praise the Lord and followers of Jesus, so-called Christians out there, are using their Bible to say that this is against God.
The Catholic Church was not even opposed to abortion until
Absolutely.
The 18th century. Yeah,
Absolutely.
So yeah, and in fact, the Catholic, you know, back, you go back to the Middle Ages and Catholic publications, because that was the only people who were allowed to write or read, you know, had manuals. It was part of medical procedures.
Right.
Phyllis, good point. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. And well said. 45 minutes past.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Whatever happened to the values of humanity? Whatever happened to the fairness and equality? Instead of spreading love, we're spreading animosity. Lack of understanding leading us away from unity. That's the reason why sometimes I'm feeling under. That's the reason why sometimes I'm feeling down. It's no wonder why sometimes I'm feeling under. Gotta keep my faith alive.
And welcome back, my friends, to the Tom Hartman Radio Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. It's 9.5 minutes before the hour. Here's another way of thinking of inflation. I've been thinking about the caller that we had from San Antonio asking about, you know, wouldn't it be inflationary? Yes, it would take more dollars to buy a bunch of carrots, but you would have more dollars in your paycheck. Now, that on its surface sounds like the definition of inflation, but think of it this way. The purpose of money is really to represent something that has value. And the core value, in my opinion, that money should represent, historically money has represented the value of a thing, like gold, for example, or silver, or the net wealth of a nation. I believe that our value unit, our dollar, should be based on the value of labor, which is a radical reinvention of the idea of labor. But just to think about it in those terms for a minute, if you want to understand inflation, you could say that right now I have to work, say, for example, just to pull numbers out of the air, I have to work an hour in order to have enough money to buy a loaf of bread. And if my wages went up 10% and that loaf of bread went up 3% because the small component of the loaf of bread, which is labor, went up, now I only have to work 50 minutes to buy that loaf of bread. Even though I'm spending more dollars, you know, more money for that bread. You get this? There's actually less. My labor, it takes less of my labor to buy the same amount of bread. This being the result of getting cheap labor out of the labor force and allowing the price of labor to rise. This was what, you know, David Ricardo wrote about this in 1814. In a treatise called On Wages. He called this his iron law of wages. And he said, whenever there's a surplus of labor, then the price of labor will always settle down to a subsistence level. And the only thing that will create what we call a middle class, because a subsistence level is the working poor. It's what we call poverty in the United States. The only thing that will create a middle class is if there is a shortage of labor relative to demand. And that's what progressives have been fighting for since the late 1800s, is to create literally a shortage of labor relative to demand that will drive up the price of labor. And Ricardo also goes on to say, by the way, by and large, an increase in the cost of labor as a result of its scarcity will not cause inflation, and it will not even significantly inflate the price of goods. It will instead reduce profits. And he was right. And what we've seen over the last 30 years, as labor has become cheaper, is not so much that goods have become cheaper, but that profits have become greater. So, anyway, I you know, not to get too arcane or too, erudite or whatever here on this, it's pretty important stuff. KJ in Camas, Washington. Hey, KJ, what's on your mind today? KJ? KJ must be listening to the radio instead of the phone. Let's go to Jim in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Jim.
Hi, Tom. You know what? I think a lot about this, and I'm wondering, where are the terrorists? Are they in Iraq, or are they 10 billion strong in our country? Because these people come across here, they're earbent on deceiving our government so they could stay here. They're in the country illegal, taking our work. And when you talk about wages and work, you know, the products going higher, what are we paying for the products coming in from China and other foreign countries? They're gouging us for garbage. I mean, the products last 30 days. We have to buy new ones. So if we had the Americans working, we would be feeding our school districts with tax money from these jobs, and we would have these illegal aliens off our welfare rolls and invading our schools, so the school districts won't be flooded with charges like that. But why can't we spend the money, you know, defending our country here in our country and let the law enforcement agencies get rid of these illegals?
Well, you make a good point, Jim. And first of all, I think that to call illegal immigrants terrorists is you know, hyperbolic. It's just it's more than.
Well, what is terrorism?
Well, terrorism is the intentional death. No, I think that, you know, that's something else. You know, terrorism.
Could we have the corporate elite programming this so it would happen? You know, if a company moves out of the country and they hire foreign labor at about one-fourth of what they pay in this country, wouldn't that be anti-labor?
It is, and it's anti-American.
And why wouldn't our government charge them with anti-labor charges?
They certainly should. I mean, this is the thing that what you have done, Jim, is you have identified the two issues that are the left and right hand of the conservative philosophy, you know, merging together and making the giant fist that is crushing the American middle class. And one is our international trade policies, which are absolutely insane, having drunk the Kool-Aid of Tom Friedman and the other flat earthers. And decided that national boundaries don't count, that everything should just be done for multinational corporations. In other words, bringing in cheap labor, even though the cheap labor is outside the nation, bringing in the products made with cheap labor. And the other is that, okay, we can bring in cheap labor in that form and make corporations more profitable by bringing in products from China and other countries. But there's also always going to be things here in the United States that you can't ship off to China. You can't ship off to China cleaning hotel rooms. You can't ship off to China, you know, the construction work, things like that. And so instead they say, okay, well, in that area we can increase profits by bringing in illegal labor. And this all is about increasing corporate profits. And that's why half the Democrats out there are not going to go against it, because you got the whole DLC in bed with the corporate profit crowd. They're all about corporate profits. And it's why most of the Republicans are not going to oppose it. Although, you know, you've got then the racist Republicans who are, oh, no, it's brown people coming, you know, and they're doing that. But this is an issue that I think it's just a shame that there's so much demagoguery about, and people just don't understand the raw fundamentals of it. Remember, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it.
To the Tom Hartman program, check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.